Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. We are back again with Dr. Sandra Gumpf being interviewed by Patrick Bufuma as part of the EMID podcast series. If you'll remember, Dr. Gumpf also has Gumpf's ID Pearls. Check it out. The website is linked in the show notes as well. And this time they're going to talk about antibiotic stewardship in the emergency department and some unique cases. So let's go ahead and dive right into this. Again, quick apologies for the audio quality.
I do want to talk a little bit on stewardship, sort of going back onto the last conversation we had. In the IDSA guidelines, they talk about giving a dose of ceftriaxone followed by oral Levaquin and for pyelonephritis. And I just don't quite get it. It just doesn't seem to make sense to me. What are your thoughts there?
Right. From those guidelines, it's 2011. I think what they were trying to get at is for that patient who's too nauseated initially for oral antibiotics, or if they're very sick and you have a concern about them just taking PO, the options that they gave and the way I interpreted it is if you want to provide 24-hour coverage, you can. You can do an IV quinolone, which would be levofloxacin, would give you 24-hour coverage. You can do ceftriaxone, or you can do once daily dose of aminoglycoside, the 5 to 7 milligrams per kilo dose. And that would cover you for 24 hours where the patient doesn't have to take pills. And hopefully they're improving by that time and they can start taking the oral. That's how I interpreted it. The guidelines at that time were first-line quinolones for uncomplicated UTI and pyelonephritis. I think at that time, they were considered fairly safe. They definitely have an advantage of having high oral bioavailability, so they're very similar to IV in terms of dosing. They're bactericidal. They definitely result in a faster cure for a pyelonephritis than beta-lactams. So they were the obvious choice for a first-line treatment. Now, it's 8 years later, and a lot of us are starting to move away from first-line quinolones, at least those of us in ID and internal medicine. For us, we've experienced a lot of resistance. Our antibiogram for gram-negative, like for E. coli, on our antibiogram, it's like 50% susceptibility for quinolone for either levofloxacin or cipro. For us, it's not the best choice for those patients. Second, over the years, there have been increasing recognition of issues like hypoglycemia. We have a lot of diabetics on insulin, the issue with tendon rupture, and there just came out maybe about a month ago warnings from the FDA about an increased risk of aortic aneurysms and dissection and rupture. And that was pretty significant. They were looking at their own case reports and four studies. It looks like the risk is twice the average population for aortic dissection. So we know now that the quinolones actually have a number of different effects on connective tissue, where it can reduce the synthesis of collagen. It can affect some of the enzymes that rebuild or remodel tendons and connective tissues. So when you look at histopathology, it actually looks like overuse injury, except it happens a lot faster. It happens with overuse. So there may be micro injuries, there may be micro ruptures in these tissues. Looking overall at the big picture, the warnings about aortic aneurysm and dissection and tendon rupture make a lot of sense.
So this is something that I've kind of wondered about in emergency medicine. There's a lot of fluoroquinol hate, is sort of how I've put it. And you know, we've seen that sepsis, or at least in the septic shock patient, that you are and flu is that they're an increased risk for cardiovascular disease. And so I kind of wonder if this is just, we were at a time where we were giving a lot of fluoroquinolones and they just kind of went under the microscope, versus like comparing fluoroquinolones to, you know, I think we use a lot of ceftriaxone nowadays. Is ceftriaxone going to be the next one that we dislike in 5 years? So I guess my question is, do you really think this is fluoroquinolone specific, or do you just think that it was, they're the ones that were under the microscope and we really, really liked Cipro and levofloxacin 10 years ago?
Well, I think a lot of us really want to like fluoroquinolones because they really work. The problem is that there is a fair amount of evidence now, including histopathologic evidence and in vitro evidence of what they do. So, and it's a class effect. It's not specific to one of them. Definitely doesn't happen with the cephalosporins or beta-lactams or other drugs. It's become very clear that this is a class issue with the quinolones, as much as I want to love them.
that takes a lot of effort to say. So like, I guess if we're coming out and saying it and admitting the love that we had, understood.
They're great antibiotics, but they're just unpleasant side effects.
Yes, it's hard to come back from aortic dissections.
Yeah.
All right. Vancomycin, first line for cellulitis. Discuss. And this is the non-sick patient that is not neck fash.
In my experience, we see two types of cellulitis. And both of them wind up on vancomycin.
But so, they all do, right?
And they call me. The first and most common one that we see in our older population is a cellulitis associated with chronic lymphedema and venous stasis. Or these are patients who've either had bad veins or they've had vein harvesting for a bypass, that sort of thing. And those patients are overwhelmingly infected with group A strep or one of the streptococci. Those patients are often, when we see them, on something like vancomycin and Zosyn and not getting better for 3 or 4 days. We come along, we stop that, and we put them on penicillin G and clindamycin usually, and they start to get better. It may still take a long time. Those patients, regardless with venous stasis and chronic, especially bad chronic lymphedema, they ordinarily have some residual redness and swelling and pain. So it takes a while. It may take a week of antibiotics or even longer for some of those patients. That patient may actually benefit from anti-inflammatory treatment. I wouldn't use the for chronic lymphedema, venous stasis associated cellulitis. I don't think those patients benefit at all from vancomycin.
So they benefit from the Zosyn.
I see a lot of doxycycline for cellulitis in lower extremities, and doxycycline covers strep or Staph aureus very well, but it doesn't cover strep well at all. So those patients, definitely vanco is low on my list of choices. The second group of patients, and probably the type that you're referring to, is the patient who has maybe a boil or cellulitis after a puncture wound or from insect bites or an IV drug user, somebody who's had a surgical procedure. And usually that type of cellulitis, if you see pus, that's really helpful. That tells you that's much more likely to be Staph aureus. If it's an abscess, that's not strep. That's going to be Staph aureus. And very often, those are going to have community-acquired MRSA. In our community, I'd say it's probably 30% of the staff in the community is probably MRSA, community-acquired MRSA. those are also much more likely to have virulence factors that are more likely to cause worse things, cellulitis and abscesses and deep tissue infections. That's the patient that I would give vancomycin to if I had a choice. If you have somebody who's not quite that sick, you could go with something like doxycycline or Ceftra, something fairly mild. Even if they have an abscess and it's been drained adequately, they're doing okay, they're not having fevers, you can probably send that patient home on doxycycline or Ceftra or clindamycin. You can do clindamycin as well.
So what I'm not hearing here is cephalexin. One thing that I vaguely recall from, it's got to be at least 5 years ago, was if you get an abscess that sort of has that like necrotic plug, that is more likely to be an MRSA infection. Is there any truth to that? Am I making that up? Is that like a thought that I've misplaced?
Right. That's the kind of infection that people think is a spider bite. We hear that all the time down here. People, I'd say, I've got a spider bite for sure. I've got a spider bite and it's not getting better. And it's usually community acquired MRSA.
It
looks like that. It's got that necrotic center or a lot of purulence. Necrosis is pretty common because of that virulence factor, Panton, Valentine, Poseidon virulence factor. I got a call from the emergency room once. They were telling me, this lady's here. She says she's got cellulitis and she thinks that it's from a spider. And I'll be darned if she doesn't walk in with a spider in a jar. She had been bitten by a black widow. I kept that for a while.
So on the topic of vancomycin and MRSA, what are some of your thoughts on these long-acting, like dalbavancin, oritavancin? I thought it might be a decent idea for the person who sort of keeps coming back, but some of these clinical trials aren't overwhelming to me with not a great response rate for something that costs thousands of dollars. So what's your thought there?
I'm with you. We haven't found a really good role for it, at least in my practice. You really need to, this is not for the person who is just coming in and doesn't have good follow-up, just comes to the emergency room for their care. I would use dalbavancin. I've occasionally considered using dalbavancin in the patient who needs maybe extended antibiotics but can't do daily. And I know what it is. I know that it's susceptible. I know that patient has follow-up with me. That's the patient who maybe, if you think that patient needs a week of therapy, I would be hesitant to just give them a dose and send them off without really knowing what's going on and having a really clear follow-up.
What about a role for vancomycin in pneumonia? When I feel like everyone that gets admitted gets vancomycin and, Zosyn or cefepime, and I feel like that can't possibly be good for everyone that's not going to the ICU.
Right.
What are your thoughts there?
Right. Well, our sepsis protocol includes vancomycin or MRSA coverage only for those patients who are going to the ICU with pneumonia. Even in those patients, it's probably overkill. Because really, less than 5% of community-acquired pneumonia is due to Staph aureus. And Staph aureus is very hard to miss. It's usually severe pneumonia. It's usually progressive. Patients have developed necrotizing or cavitating pneumonia. They usually are going to come in septic and febrile and toxic-looking. Those patients, you get somebody like that in the emergency room, I should suspect them not only to have MRSA, but Group A strep or Pseudomonas. They need coverage for that. And those patients, you want an agent that's bactericidal or that blocks toxin production, especially for the Staph aureus and Group A strep. For Staph pneumonia in general, even though we include vancomycin often first line, and a lot of these protocols, it's not really the best option. You know, it doesn't penetrate well or quickly, rather, into alveolar fluids. And a lot of these patients have some nephrotoxicity from sepsis anyway. So we have better choices. For severe CAP, where you might suspect MRSA, and you're obviously also suspecting pneumococcus, probably first line, at least first line so far, remains linazolid, because we have the most data for that. And it also inhibits toxin production. Linazolid is bacteriostatic. It's not bactericidal, but definitely there's reduced morbidity compared to vancomycin and other drugs in pneumonia and staph pneumonia. The other drug that is increasingly used is ceftaroline, which is one of the more advanced cephalosporins. And it is bactericidal, and it also clears bacteremia. Bacteremia is not something that linazolid treats very well. And as you know, sometimes Staph aureus can be metastatic or spread to other sites due to bacteremia. So ceftaroline is sounding more and more like a better option and can be considered first line.
What about adding in azithromycin? I've seen some times where some people get on their high horse about adding it to the vancomycin coverage. Sometimes I've seen it argued to be, you know, anti-inflammatory. And then I've seen some that says it's take it or leave it. Any strong data one way or the other that you've seen?
Definitely for the patient who is going to be hospitalized. Or is really, if they're sick enough to come to the emergency room. I mean, maybe they're not quite that sick when they come to the emergency room, but if they're sick enough to be hospitalized, then I would cover for both the quote-unquote typical bacterial pathogens as well as the atypicals, quote-unquote Legionella and Chlamydia and Varicella, all those other organisms. You can definitely be infected with more than one thing, and the better we're able to screen for infections, especially with newer molecular diagnostics, we're finding that patients don't necessarily have one infection going on, especially in things like the lung. For those patients, it's worth covering with two agents. You can use azithromycin as your second agent for atypicals, or you can use levofloxacin. The advantage to your azithromycin is that it does have an anti-inflammatory effect, which can be a benefit. If I had to choose, I would go with the azithromycin.
I'm going to hop back here. So you had mentioned molecular testing. I cross-cover our emergency department, our PAs cross-cover the observation unit as well. So we split our time, which is nice because we get to see what happens on the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
I've wondered about doing like MRSA swabs for the cellulitis patients and then just trying to see if we need to be giving them vancomycin or not. But then it seems like it's not necessarily always correlating between the nasal swab and, you know, the leg or the pus pocket.
Right. Yeah, you're totally right. Generally, Staph aureus, if you're colonized with Staph aureus, it's usually going to be the nares and nostrils, and it doesn't necessarily correlate with infection, whatever MRSA infection is going on anywhere else. We use it more for infection control purposes to try and prevent spread of MRSA that may colonize other patients, but we don't necessarily use it to predict infection. It doesn't correlate.
Okay. Last question here. Adjunctive treatments, NSAIDs or steroids for your cellulitis. Looks like you're not you'd like to let the disease run its course, it seems like. Thoughts on that from you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't use a lot of steroids. I have an older population of patients. I might be more comfortable with steroids and non-steroidals in a younger population that didn't have diabetes and chronic kidney disease. And to me, for other than really significant cellulitis, the benefit of steroids in particular is not really worth the risks. I've seen people develop avascular necrosis of the hip, even with a short-term course of steroids. So I just try to avoid it. Some of my patients are diabetic, and of course, I don't want to mess up their sugars. That can last for a while. And if anything, I think non-steroidals would be fine. There's definitely data to support using short course of corticosteroids and some relatively uncomplicated cellulitis to try and increase the speed of resolution. For maybe those patients who have a more severe chronic lymphedema-associated cellulitis, I would consider it there.
Thank you so much. I think we covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah, that's good.
Any other, sounds like we got a lot of sort of tips and tricks for the ED and sort of calling out a lot of bad behavior. So, anything else that sort of sticks out in your mind that we had talked about? It seems like we talked about using vanco sparingly, really thinking twice if fluoroquinolones are the right thing, not necessarily needing to culture every urine unless they're really symptomatic. Anything else high yield you're thinking for the emergency department, stewardship or otherwise?
I guess the only other thing that I might, and I'm not entirely sure how to advise you. We still see a lot of use of antibiotics in URIs. And I think that's a definite area for improvement. It's probably something that we're going to be working on. I'm hoping to be working on with our emergency room, part of an antimicrobial stewardship project in the near future.
So... I was at a talk. This is some of these things that sort of changed the way I've practiced. There's one person by the name of Jerry Hoffman who says something to the effect of words matter. Don't tell them that they have bronchitis. Tell them they have a chest cold. And sort of things like that. The expectation actually is much less there, which is really surprising. But the it's amazing how if you just, unfortunately, the discharge papers still say bronchitis, which not that you need any recommendations from me, but if you could have them change that in their EMR, that might make things a little easier.
I don't hold out any hope.
So thank you so much for your time. Really happy to have you join me. You seem like a very busy person. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That wraps up this podcast. Thank you so much, Patrick, for interviewing. And thank you so much, Dr. Gumpf, for being a part of the EMID podcast series as part of Total EM. Again, apologies for the audio quality, but otherwise this was great. And I'm so glad that they were both able to participate. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.